This is Gary Parr, Editorial Director, Maintenance Technology Magazine, and I'm here with Ken Bannister. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for inviting me today.
Yes, Ken joining us for this podcast as part of a new effort in 2017. Anyone who is a regular reader of Maintenance Technology knows that Ken is our lubrication expert and writes an article each month for us on lubrication. And in 2017, we're going to start coupling those articles with a podcast where we talk to Ken about more about what's in that month's article and or items that are related to it. So very excited to have this new initiative, and also want to get a plug in for Ken's new book. Ken has co-authored with Heinz Block a book, Practical Lubrication for Industrial Facilities, 3rd Edition. And that's just within the past few months here, Ken. I assume we can get it through Amazon and the other usual channels?
Yes, I believe it's fully available now at Amazon.com. And through your regular bookstore, they can get it for you also.
Okay, so 3rd edition. So you guys have been, has each of these been co-authored with Heinz?
This is the first time I've collaborated with Heinz. We've added extensively to the book in regards to the application engineering of applying lubricants to machines. So added in that respect, and it is the 3rd edition, it's the first co-authored edition in that regard.
Okay, so two solo efforts and a co-author then.
You betcha.
Okay. All right, so Ken's January article addresses motor and gearbox lubrication practices, and really two different subjects here, dealing with motors and obviously lubricating the bearings that are in the motors, and then, of course, gearboxes when you have systems that attach a gearbox to the motor so you can adjust speed. But so let's talk about motors and lubricating them. And we were having a little conversation here before we started recording about some of the tragedies that go on in various factories when it comes to lubrication or lack thereof. But what we're talking about here, Ken, is motors that are typically in the 20 horsepower range, your larger motors. And the smaller ones, as you say in your article, any more these days have sealed bearings on them. And of course, sealed bearings means you don't have to grease them. Really, sealed bearings to most people means no maintenance. But you do have to monitor these things. Am I right? I mean, you can't just ignore these bearings, even though they're sealed. You have to keep track of them because they eventually will wear out.
Like anything, Gary, everything has a life, and that life is all depending on how the equipment is being used or abused in any sort of circumstance. So you have to pick the right motor gearbox assembly for the work that you perform. So hopefully that's been taken care of. And when you look at sort of sub-fractional horsepower motors or smaller horsepower motors up to the 20 horsepower and above, below, we usually find that you will not have grease nipples or the ability to actually lubricate these units. When the unit is being used in a heavy duty application, usually you will find that there is the ability to lubricate the bearing in that particular case and add lubricant to it, because it will require regular monitoring and maintenance with regards to lubrication of the bearing under heavy load conditions or heavy load slow moving conditions. So that's about choosing the right type of motor assembly for the type of work it is to perform. Lighter duty stuff is basically lubricated for the life of the unit. And all you have to do is make sure that the unit's kept clean and the unit is set up correctly in that it is aligned properly. Because if you misalign it, it will wear out prematurely. And that's not a basis of the lubrication, but because of the alignment system, as the way it's been aligned.
You said something there that I think gets ignored an awful lot when you said that units need to be kept clean. In your experience, you see that to be a major problem? People just let dirt and grime accumulate on motors and gearboxes and let heat build up. Is that a common problem, or do people make an effort to clean, keep these things clean?
Well, you sometimes see in the CMMS work order systems, which is to clean the unit. Whether that's actually done correctly or not is another thing. Again, depending on the environment the motor works in, for instance, in a cement plant or in a foundry, it can easily accumulate a blanket of dirt on the motor gearbox assembly that will act as an insulator. What that insulator does is it raises the temperature of the oil and the bearings inside. And this is where we get the Arrhenius rule comes into application where it's applied, because for every 18 degrees Fahrenheit that you raise the temperature of the oil or the piece of equipment, you are half-lifing that equipment or oil. And inversely, if you lower the temperature, you get twice the life. So it is quite important in that effect. As the temperature raises, the oil will oxidize much quicker, and then you'll start to get failures in your bearings and failure of the lubricant itself prematurely. So yes, it's an important thing to look at, and keeping it clean, blown clean of debris, because debris also makes its way into the bearing. When you have bearings that are not sealed, which are open style bearings, what happens is when a bearing is operating, it creates a negative pressure, and that negative pressure pulls in through vacuum any residual dirt that's around the bearing, which then becomes a compound paste that basically you have free body abrasion occurring in the bearing, and premature failure will occur as a result of friction wear.
So this is I'm going to be watching that when I go in plants more often to see just how clean people's motors are, because I've been in my share, and you do see the dirty ones, and then I've been in some where, you know, somebody is obviously going through and doing some major housekeeping, and so clearly then that's part of a good reliability program there is making sure those motors are kept clean so that the temperature stays down.
And absolutely. I mean, if you open the hood of your car, would you like to work on a car that's never been looked at in 20 years, or a car that's had been cleaned regularly? We'd all choose the clean one or the new one as opposed to the old and dirty one. It's much easier to troubleshoot, and it actually uses less energy as a result of it.
When we talk about larger motors, 20 horsepower range motors, and greasing them, you mentioned in your article about they have to be greased blind, and meaning there's you can't look in the bearing to see how much grease is in there. So you have to have some system of how much grease to put into a bearing, and we all know that you can put too much in, and that's almost as damaging as not enough. What are we talking about in terms of how much grease should be in a bearing? What happens when you over-grease? We know what happens when you under-grease. They bind up and wear out. But what happens when you over-grease in a motor? What goes on there? What should people be aware of when it comes to greasing bearings?
Over-lubrication is probably just as bad, if not worse, than under-lubrication. A bearing is designed to be filled between 30 and 50% of the area, the open area around the balls or the rollers, the cage. And because what it means, it's very much like the analogy I'll give. If you're trying to, say you're running along a beach, right, and you run along the sand, and it's 100 degree day out there, you'll be like a gecko lifting your feet off there, because you could burn the bottom of your foot really easily, and you get a friction burn or a heat burn as a result of that. So what you want to do, so you tend to move towards the water side of it. If you move into 6 inches of water, I don't know if you've ever tried to run through 6 inches of water, but you've got to lift against that viscous drag of the lubricant of the water itself, which is cooling you down. But now you'll find yourself huffing and puffing and get a massive exertion, and you'll feel yourself start to go red, trying to lift out of that water. And it's very difficult. And the deeper you go, the more difficult it becomes in the water, where you're basically just wading through. That's what a bearing feels like when it's over lubricated, when there's no void in or open area in the cage. It's trying to push against the frictional resistance of the lubricant itself, so it can actually heat it up to a degree where it can actually leak some of it out and then free itself up. Well, of course, the ammeter just goes sky high at that point in terms of the amperage draw to actually overcome that frictional resistance of the lubricant. If you're running along the beach now and run in basically 1 inch of water, there's a huge difference, and we probably all experience this in real life. But running, it feels nice. You're splashing the water up on you. It feels cool. You're getting that draft of air over the cold water there, and you could run all day long in that area in 100 degree weather. Well, maybe not all day long, but certainly there's a lot less resistance, and that's where a bearing, when it's lubricated correctly, that's how it's supposed to feel and operate. In doing so, it's a matter of understanding how much lubricant should go in. You basically just take a grease gun, and we're saying we're doing it blind. By putting a grease gun onto a grease nipple, we're not putting a measured amount in. How much is a shot of grease out of your grease lubricator or your grease gun? Because there's virtually no grease gun the same as another. They're hydraulic devices. They also put into different amounts of output per stroke. So it can vary from a half cc up to 3 or 4 cc's on one stroke. So just to have in the PM system, 3 strokes of grease off the grease gun is not good enough. You've got to measure what the grease gun is and have put in place a grease gun program where all the grease guns are the same displacement. And in terms, they also change in pressure. In terms of, they can go from like 4,500 psi to 15,000 psi. It's a hydraulic device, don't forget. 15,000 psi against a mechanical seal that basically can only withstand about between 300 to up to 1,000 psi, usually around 600 psi is the norm for a seal. Once you deadhead and fill that void, and if you keep on going, because a lot of people like to give an extra couple of squeezes for good measure, in the old style thinking, you're going to basically deadhead against that seal, and then boom, you've blown the seal. Once the seal's blown, then it's now a dirt magnet, and it will pull all that dirt back into the grease and act as a frictional paste. So you can see now. We also know that there's two ways of doing it. We can do ultrasonics, and it'll tell you at which point you get a signature on that bearing once you understand the exact amount it should have, and you meter to that signature, that sound signature that you get. The other way is what all the lubrication companies do, is volume equals area times replenishment rate, B equals A times R. And you're looking, there are formulas for the size of the bearing and for the replenishment rate on a grease. And it's usually based on a 4-hour replenishment rate. And this is where all automated systems are set up to that type of formula. So you know, there, you need to formulate and understand how much grease it needs to be put in. It's an engineered process. It's not just fly by night putting it in. So that's where we look at putting in the right amount in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, okay. And what you're describing there in your previous writings, you really push hard on understanding what your grease guns are, making sure that you're using the same grease gun for a job that you have. You've mapped that all out, and that you just described why that's so important. To know what your grease guns do, to make sure you're using the same grease and the same gun all the time so you don't cross-contaminate, all of those things that you know, and that extra shot, you know, we're all brought up when we're, you know, oil something at home as a kid, you know, give it an extra shot, a little more oil never hurts. And it really does.
That's called killing it with kindness.
Yes. Drain plugs. Talk about drain plugs in these bearings and the role they play in the event that you have a over lubrication.
Sure. On the larger motors, you'll find on the end cap casing of the motor, you'll find a grit where that's where the grease nipple lies. And that's for the outboard bearing, which sits on the winding shaft, right? And that's the one that turns around and creates the electrical energy. So that bearing needs to be lubricated. And where it's a greasable bearing, it may just have a seal. It won't be sealed, but it may have a shield on that bearing, or it may or may not. But what it does is it has cavity. It runs down on the tube to the bearing. The grease then runs through the bearing, and it allows it to go through and then run down to the other end of the bottom end of the casing, which has a plug. What the process is that you undo the plug first, and then you lubricate the exact amount of shots that you need to lubricate into the motor. The excess is then sloughed off down through the open drain plug area at the bottom of the case. And then once you complete it, you put the actual plug back into the casing. This, if you don't do this, it will now fill up that tube. And for instance, if you don't take the plug off, it can fill the tube up. It then goes the path of least resistance, which is directly into the windings. And if the plug is left off, it allows dirt to work its way back in. But that's not as important, because the dirt will always be flushed out if you're doing a regular grease program. It just keeps things nice and clean and tidy. But if the plug was left off and you were lubricating regularly, that would be good. You never take the plug off when you lubricate. That's really, really bad. And these are, when you take the actual case cap off, you can actually see all what this looks like. And I'd recommend that anybody who's not greased a motor like that before, if a millwright or take the end cap off when the motor's not running, and just check, and you'll see exactly what you're looking at in terms of the path that the grease follows, and you'll understand why we do it in such a way.
Now, dumb guy question here. So if I'm speccing a large motor, 20 horsepower motor, obviously I need the right horsepower. I need all the things you'd look for in a motor, but also on my checklist then should be a grease fitting and a drain. And can we assume that those are always on those bearings or no?
No, there's no, we can't make an assumptions. We used to state many years ago that you only lubricate motors of 50 horsepower and above. They've now come to, because there's more finite control and the lubricants are better, they're now moving down towards the 20 horsepower, where they've given you the ability to lubricate. And again, it's usually a question of how is that motor loaded, and this is where the motor manufacturer gives the ability to actually lubricate it or not. It's very uncommon, should I say, to find a motor around 20 horsepower that's not lubricated. You can't lubricate. The ones you have to be aware of is a lot of the smaller motors that come from offshore, which are inexpensive and they just put a grease nipple in it, but with no plug. Be very suspectful of something that has no plug with a grease nipple. You must take real good care not to over lubricate that, because it will go directly into the winding. What I recommend there is take the grease nipple off and run it as a sealed system.
Well, that's exactly why I bring this up, is in this day of order online, get the cheapest we can. You just answered my question there. Then cheapest you can is fine, but you better check and make sure that you have a grease nipple and a drain on those bearings then.
And it has a grease nipple but no drain. You've got to make a choice at this point. Do you have the ability to lubricate that correctly on a regular basis, or do you want to risk having the lubricant go into the winding, or do you want to allow it to fail naturally as a result of how the motor is being used? Treat it as a sealed bearing and let it run its course of its life and just replace it. On the smaller bearings, it's less expensive. On the larger bearings, the key is here, Gary, is that larger motors are rebuildable. And then when you actually rebuild a motor, you can have them put in place to lubricate that bearing. You can have them put a nipple in and with a plug as well. So if you're rebuilding a motor, you can spec that in rebuild. You can actually spec that in the new motor purchase specification also. And it's about having the right kind of program, though. If you're going to spec it in, be sure you know how much lubricant it does require on a regular basis. And you may even think about going to a semi-automatic system, for instance, a single-point lubricator or something like that. But again, you need to set up that single-point lubricator to give the right amount of lubricant into that bearing so you don't over-lubricate it.
Let's talk about gearboxes. There's in your article, you talk about three different kinds of lubrication methodology for gearboxes: splash, pressure, and then mist or atomized lubrication systems. And and you talk about I understood this correctly, and I'm no gearbox expert, so that's why we talked to you. A more general use is your splash lubrication system, and then in your mid to large, you'll use a pressurized system, and then your largest motors or gearboxes, I'm sorry, your largest gearboxes, then almost always are some kind of a mist system. Is it fairly hard and fast there, or is there a lot of variation in terms of how these gearboxes are lubricated?
Well, sometimes it's hybrid there, Gary, too. In terms of the small to mid size, it may rely on splash, which is really a pickup, where the gear teeth are in the lubricant, bathed in the lubricant, and it pulls it up and it transfers it from one gear to another. The pressure, depending on the design of the gear train and gearbox, for instance, if you have some bearings that are outside of the reservoir, sort of sitting above the reservoir fill line, you will then have to put in like a pressure system. And what that is, a pump, usually driven from the gear train itself, transfers and pours oil over the bearings and over the gear train as well. So that's when we go on a pressure system, that's usually what it is in the small to medium size. Once you get into the larger gearboxes, and I'm talking about gearboxes that you can put a TV in and a comfortable armchair, and the really large ones that are found in pulp paper industries, found in the mining industry, and in the oil and gas industry, these ones, they can be filled with 1,000 gallons of lubricant in them. And they'll use a mixture of pressure, or they'll use atomization style, which is a vane pump, which basically pulls it out in a pressured manner. It pulls, suctions the oil up, and then it basically throws the lubricant at a plate in crude terms, and then atomizes it, and it becomes a fog. They're often called mist or fog lubricators. And that fog then saturates around the bearing and the teeth of the gears and everything. So it really depends on the size. Those are really big motors, sometimes quarter horsepower, half horsepower motors, and bigger that are used to energize that amount of fogging in the system.
Okay, and then when we have these gearboxes, then there's obviously a whole maintenance process that goes with them in terms of monitoring that oil, the oil condition, the amount that's in there, keeping the gearboxes clean. What are some of the key things that someone would want to keep in mind or put on a work order that if you're going to maintain a gearbox, you need to do these things?
Sure, good question. For instance, we want the level set correctly at the gearbox because the level is crucial in the gearbox in so much as we don't want to overfill. I mean, think of your car. When you pull the dipstick out on the car, that's basically a gearbox sitting in the bottom of the engine there. They're usually combined, right, of the engine. It'll have a low and a high on the dipstick, and you've got to fill between those two lines. So that's a visual indicator showing how much you should fill. And you'll see a warning from the manufacturer that it's not a good thing. You have to take it into a technician and have them take some of the oil out. They can usually suction or siphon it out or drop open the drain plug and drain some out. When you overfill like that, what you're doing is you're causing a phenomenon called churning. And what that does is it's the gear is actually cutting the lubricant up and churning it and creating foam at that point and creating it, so there's creating bubbles within the oil. And it's starting to aerate the oil. And it's very much like when I just described you're running through 6 to 8 inches of water. It has to overcome that fluid friction, and as opposed to running in 1 inch of water where it just does a natural pickup and splash. So overfilling becomes very detrimental because it actually degrades the oil and it degrades the anti-foaming package, because it's now trying to collapse that air. If it's hydraulics, then we start to get all kinds of problems due to air entrainment in it, and we'll get hammering in the system, which creates wear. Same as it's cavitating the pump at the same time. So it creates all kinds of problems by overfilling. Underfilling, well, then we don't get any lubricant pickup at all. So it's pretty obvious in that one. So when we're talking about fill levels, if your reservoir has just an eye plug with a line across it, if the lubricant's not changed regularly, it can stain with the old oxidized oil and make you think you've got the right kind of you've got the right level of lubricant in there, when all you're seeing is an oil stain. So ideally, if that's the system you have, it's better to put in a sight level gauge that's the tube style. So it sits in the very bottom and it sits to the top and it shows you where the level is actually in a tube outside of the reservoir. That's the style that I would recommend. And to see even better than that, you can just put a piece of card with diagonal lines across it, which really refracts against the oil that shows you where the actual level is much, much clearer as a result. And then establish where the low and the high level should be, and then screw into the unit or put a little drive plug into it that with pointers that show low and high. So the oil level, you're then just looking to see if it's in between those two lines.
When we're looking at gearboxes, if I have gearboxes that say I've got three different gearboxes that use three different systems, I can't just assume that the same oil works for all of those, can I?
Good question. Yes, and this is where it depends on the usage factor, of its environment, and it depends on the heat that it works up in terms of the what's being transferred, the speeds, and so on and so forth. You can get, for instance, an air tool oil is a 40 weight viscosity, 20 to 40 weight viscosity, whereas gearboxes do have gear oils in them, which run around a 220 weight viscosity. So it's much thicker oil in that regard. So the key is what it was designed to use initially and then hold with that viscosity and only replace it with the proper lubricant. So keep your lubricants so they are designed. Like, for instance, if you look at cars these days, cars are now using a 0.5, 0.10. All the cars will run a 10.20 oil or a 10.30. If you put it, and that's finally because of the tolerances in combustion engines have become much finer as a result. So a thicker viscosity oil will basically bog it down. It'll cause a lot of viscous drag, and it actually voids the warranty in the cases of engines. But when you're dealing with gearboxes, again, they like to have the correct oil put into them in terms of what they were designed for, because gears are also meshed and made with fits, you're looking to get the optimized amount of life from that unit is you use the correct oil and don't mix your lubricants. So speak to your lubricant supplier to make sure that you're getting the correct oil or a compatible oil with the one that was put forward by the manufacturer.
Right. And then of course, all of the oil housekeeping things, filtering your oils, not cross-contaminating, keeping your gearbox clean, all those things come into play too, because any one of those can cause things to wear prematurely.
And that brings us in a nice roundabout right to the very first question, where we talked about motors and gearboxes with dirt on them. We put the dirt in there. if we ensure we're getting clean lubricant, the number of plants that I've been into where the breather has been left off the reservoirs, and or the fill cap has been left off and is still sitting on the side there. It's rotten, dirty. There's lots of residual dirt from the production process sitting on the top of the reservoir, which is just making its way into the oil itself, which creates a massive sludge in the bottom that raises the viscosity of the oil, creates a viscous drag in the system, and depletes it oxidizes the oil very, very quickly. The best way of doing gearboxes is to spend a little bit more money, especially on the larger ones, and make them closed loop systems. So when they're breathing through desiccant breathers that control what comes in and controls what goes out. And there's all kinds of these out there, these desiccant style breathers. And then when you're filling the lubricant in there, you can actually fill it through a filter cart and put on a connector system where it's a positive connection system. So no air actually gets into the system itself. And you put breathers that also have diaphragms in them that allow to naturally expand and contract, and it keeps the condensation out of the system also, which creates water if you're going through large temperature changes, especially if the gearbox is outside. It can control some of that. Other things to control condensation and for water creeping into the oil is to put thermal blankets around the units and heat them so they're always kept at a certain temperature, especially in outdoors in winter, or in unheated places in colder environments, such as in Canada and Illinois.
Yeah.
Northern states in the U.S., you know.
All right, Ken. We're out of time. I hate that. That's good. Good stuff. Appreciate it, and appreciate you making the time. And then we'll be back next month with more discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.